From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is another busy day on Capitol Hill. Four separate Senate hearings got underway at the same time today. Wilbur Ross, Nikki Haley, Scott Pruitt, and Tom Price all took questions about their respective nominations from Donald Trump. And we're going to focus for the next few minutes on Tom Price. He's a congressman from Georgia, nominated to be Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services. And he's been under scrutiny for stocks he bought while he was in Congress. Here's an exchange between him and Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken. Franken asked about the congressman's investment in the company Innate Immunotherapeutics.
You responded that you did not know that you got a discounted price. That is absolutely amazing because we discussed this.
Well, by definition, I believe that's the nature of a private placement offering. What I said to you and what I've said to others is that I paid exactly the same price as everybody else. I disclosed
it. It was a private offering that only went to about 20 people, including Representative, your colleague, Chris Collins, his chief of staff, and a prominent D.C. lobbyist.
And here's Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch defending Price.
There are members on this committee who have, as I understand it, who have traded individual health stocks while serving on this committee. Now, this appears to be nothing more than a hypocritical attack on your good character. And I personally resent it.
Joining us now is NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start there. Tell us more about this issue that they're talking about with his investment.
Well, these issues over the congressman's investments were first raised by the Wall Street Journal in December, shortly after he was announced for the nomination. In the past 4 years, his investments have included over $300,000 in trades from, I think, as many as 40 different health-related companies. Now, the thing that is key here and what Price testified today is that his argument is that he did not personally make these trades, that these trades were made on his behalf, not dissimilar to many people have in their 401ks or their pension plans, that these were not direct trades. He's also said that he will divest all of his investments if he is nominated to the post. Senate Democrats have been requesting delays on the hearing. They want to look more into these stock trades, although at this point, it does not seem like they're likely to get that.
And does it seem likely that this is something that could hold up Price being confirmed?
Well, you know, this is up to the Senate. And we should note that today's hearing was a courtesy hearing. The Senate Finance Committee is the committee that has jurisdiction over the nomination. And those are the ones that are vetting this paperwork and his ethics forms. And they're going to hold their hearing next week. But the bottom line is, in the Senate, Republicans only need a simple majority to confirm all of Trump's cabinet nominees. And if you listen to the hearing today, Republicans are overwhelmingly in support of Price for HHS secretary.
And the big issue for the HHS secretary is going to be Obamacare. What happens to it? What the replacement looks like? Here's Price talking about the Affordable Care Act.
Nobody's interested in pulling the rug out from under anybody. We believe that it's absolutely imperative that individuals that have health coverage be able to keep health coverage and move, hopefully, to greater choices and opportunities for them to gain the kind of coverage that they want for themselves and for their family. So I think there's been a lot of talk about individuals losing health coverage. That is not our goal, nor is it our desire, nor is it our plan.
Did we learn anything more about what the plan is to repeal and replace Obamacare?
Well, the fact that he said that the Republican replacement plan will not strip anyone of coverage certainly echoes comments also made by President-elect Donald Trump. We don't know exactly what that will look like. He also spoke of his intention to reduce regulations in the law. The HHS secretary will have enormous leeway into ways that they can affect the implementation or repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And he also agreed, which was an interesting point, with Health Chairman Lamar Alexander, a senator from Tennessee, that the repeal plan will only focus on the individual market and Medicaid. There was agreement that there will be no effort to touch Medicare in this Obamacare repeal and replace fight.
Hmm. What was the tone of the hearing overall?
You know, Price, I've covered him for a long time. He's a very composed man. He was an orthopedic surgeon before he came to Congress. I think there was multiple efforts by Democrats to sort of provoke him or ruffle feathers. That's sort of the nature of these hearings. And he really remained composed and took a lot of the incoming fire with an even keel. And, of course, he had a lot of Senate Republicans backing him up who said that he is one of the most qualified nominees that they've ever seen for the post, particularly because of that medical background that he has.
And of course, it is just one, as we said, of four hearings going on today. Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, Nikki Haley for Ambassador to the United Nations, and Scott Pruitt for head of the Environmental Protection Agency, all being grilled by senators today. We'll be watching all of it. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Well, there's been a lot of reaction to President Obama's clemency decisions yesterday, pardoning or forgiving the crimes of 64 people, commuting or shortening the sentences of 209 others. But most of the reaction has been about former Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning, convicted of that 2010 leak of classified information to WikiLeaks when she was called Bradley Manning. She's since been living as a transgender woman in a men's military prison, jailed for 7 years of her 35-year sentence. Speaker of the House Paul Ryan called the commutation of that sentence outrageous, said that she endangered Americans and foreign officials who worked with them. But Chelsea Manning herself has been remorseful, and her many supporters include Evan Greer, a friend and activist with the group Fight for the Future. She joins us in the studio. Evan, what was your reaction to the commutation?
First, I wept, and I was on the train, so that was a little awkward. I was just overjoyed. Over the year of coming to get to know Chelsea, I've become a friend of hers, and I just can't wait to see her in person and give her a hug.
Now, you are also a transgender, two female, and I'm wondering, is that how you knew her? Is there a community that gathered around her?
Yeah, so we do share that we're both trans. I think she reached out to me originally through my activism as a free speech activist, but I've come to know her as a whole human being, not just as a hero or an icon, as the press often paints her.
Well, what do you say to the people, though, who say the files she copied included about 250,000 diplomatic cables from American embassies showing sensitive deals and conversations? She might have put lives at risk. And she leaked to the same outlet, Julian Assange's WikiLeaks, that people are now seeing as perhaps destructive and partisan after its role in leaking those documents that may have been hacked by the Russians to upset and interfere in the American election. You know, people are doubly angry. And actually, we're surprised because of the WikiLeaks connection that President Obama would do the commutation. What do you say to those people?
You know, first, it's incredibly important to understand that even the U.S. intelligence community has agreed that no real harm came from Chelsea Manning's disclosures. Really, what she did is shed light on the devastating impact that U.S. foreign policy in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have had on civilians. She has no affiliation with WikiLeaks. Her decision to release documents to them was not an endorsement of that organization. And in fact, she did attempt to contact other news organizations who ignored her before those documents were sent to WikiLeaks. But however you feel about Chelsea Manning's initial actions that landed her in prison, it became clear that she had suffered enough. She'd served more time in prison than any other whistleblower in U.S. history. She'd been systematically denied access to gender-related health care. She'd attempted suicide twice. She had done her time, and it was time for her to be let free.
Okay. And then I remember all the pieces that we did. Yes, there's a huge backing that considered her a whistleblower, and others considered her a traitor. But then also her supporters are saying, well, how come she leaked sensitive material and got the long sentence that you mentioned, but people like David Petraeus, who gave sensitive material to his biographer and mistress, didn't get any time at all? So that's the debate we wade into. But have you spoken to her since the president's commutation?
So we've been waiting to speak to her, I cannot wait to hear her voice. And my understanding is that she has been told, and we're all waiting anxiously to hear from her.
I think her release will be sometime in May.
That's correct.
I understand. What happens now? It's always a new world when you come out of prison, but for her in particular, what happens now?
I know that Chelsea's friends and family and supporters will be rallying around her. And I know that she's going to continue fighting for what she believes in. She's always been motivated by a desire to do the right thing and to help people. She's become an inspiration for the transgender community. And by fighting for her own rights, she stood up for all of us. She's going to help numerous trans people behind bars and who are free as well. And we owe Chelsea Manning a huge thanks.
Because to remind people who haven't followed this, she announced after she was charged in prison that it was a huge shock that she wanted to go through the procedure.
It's incredible to imagine the bravery of someone who announces to the world that they're transgender on the Today Show while they're incarcerated in an all-male military prison in Kansas. You know, the courage of this woman knows no bounds.
Well, do you worry for her? You're nodding. A transgendered person and someone who many people consider a traitor because she leaked information.
I think it's also important to remember that so many people consider her to be a hero. I know that those people will be there attempting to protect her no matter what comes next. And I think for so many people in this world right now, we are vulnerable with the incoming administration. Trans people everywhere are going to be in more danger, but we're also going to stick together and we're going to keep fighting to take care of our own.
Well, you say in danger with the new administration. Just a quick thought on that. Donald Trump has surprised some of his backers, for instance, saying that Caitlyn Jenner is a friend of his and can stay in his hotels anytime. You know, you don't really know what your future is in a Trump administration.
You know, the reality is that politicians from both parties have repeatedly said that they are in solidarity and support of the transgender community and have repeatedly failed us. And I think at this point, and we're not going to put our faith in any individual politician or president to protect us. We're going to protect ourselves and each other.
That's Evan Greer, a friend of Chelsea Manning's and an activist with the group Fight for the Future. Evan, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on, Robin.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
In just 2 days, the United States will witness the inauguration of its 45th president, Donald J. Trump. There are more than 800,000 people expected to attend from all over the country. Although, as we've noted, there will be plenty of protesters and more than 50 Democratic lawmakers planning to boycott. But you know what? Inaugurations haven't always gone smoothly. Let's take a look back at some of the more notable and sometimes imperfect moments in inaugural history with Ed Ayers and Joanne Freeman, their historians and co-hosts of the weekly public radio show and podcast Backstory. Ed and Joanne, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks very much.
And Joanne, I want to go to you first and start with the very beginning. Back on April 30th, 1789, George Washington's inauguration, which took place on the balcony of Federal Hall in New York. Now, nowadays, we have our established traditions about these things. But back then, there were no traditions. What was going on at that moment? And what was going on in Washington's head?
Yeah. Well, that was a weird moment, right? Because I think always in American history, when you think about the founding, it feels like it was forever ago. And then you thus assume that everything that happened then, of course, was sort of preordained. But there had never been a president before. At the time when the American Republic was starting, they were just kings. So what is a president? And what do you do to actually make a president? What does that ceremony look like? And nobody knew. And Washington is sort of stuck in this position where he feels hugely responsible for somehow being whatever a president is supposed to be. And apparently, based on witnesses who saw his swearing the oath and then his equivalent of an inaugural address, he was so afraid that his hands were shaking.
Mm. And actually, he said in his address, no event could have filled me with greater anxieties than being called upon to serve as president. So he was nervous on that very first one. What about in 1829 with Andrew Jackson? It didn't sound like was quite as nervous. It was more of a celebration. They called it one of the wildest presidential inaugurations ever.
Yeah. So Jackson, you know, he was trying to make a political point, right? Andrew Jackson campaigned and presented himself as, you know, the president of the people, the president of the common man. And along those lines, when he staged or planned his inauguration, he decided one of the things he would do is have basically an open house at the White House so the American people can come and celebrate his inauguration. And of course, what happened was stampeding tens of thousands of people went to the White House and rampaged through the White House. And he had to sort of sneak out to get away.
And they broke a lot of china, we hear.
And they broke a lot of china and messed up some rugs, yeah.
And well, spill that punch all over the floor. Oh, it was such a mess.
They're still getting the stains out today. Ed, take us to 1861 and President Lincoln. Lincoln hired a private detective to keep him safe on the way to the inauguration. Why?
Yeah, well, he kept getting letters telling him he would be assassinated along the way, basically threatening letters. And, of course, there were good reasons to believe that was the case because six states had already seceded from the United States by that time. So the big concern was he had to go through a slaveholding city, Baltimore, and that's where the threats were greatest. And so they put him in a shawl and a cape to disguise his rather distinguished appearance and snuck him through town in the middle of night. So that would haunt him for the first few months of his presidency. That shows what kind of leader he's going to be, critics said. He's too afraid to actually just show up in Washington for his inauguration.
And 4 years later, on March 4th, 1865, Lincoln's vice president, Andrew Johnson, was sworn in. And this is one of the most unusual things that I learned as I was looking back at this. He was drunk.
Well, he was sick, and then he was drunk. The problem was he
give him credit for being sick and then drunk.
Well, that's right. He had typhoid fever, and so, you know, everybody knows that whiskey is good for what ails you. So he said, well, give me a tumbler of whiskey. And then he said, well, give me two more. And then he walked into this overheated, crowded Senate chamber and had to listen to a speech, then had to give one himself. And he stood up and basically just kind of rambled like your drunk uncle. You know, he sort of talked about how he had come up from humble origins and all this. And then people were very shocked and saddened.
Including Lincoln, who looked on aghast, I read.
Yeah, the phrase said he had unutterable sorrow in his expression, and a senator covered his face with his hands. So finally, he finished up, kissed the Bible, took the oath of office, but then when it was his job to swear in new senators, he was so confused that he couldn't do it and had to hand it over to somebody else.
You know, these events remind us that we're all human. I guess in that case, typhoid fever, and then he goes for the whiskey. But in 1857, Joanne, James Buchanan gets up there, and then the worst happens. Tell us about it.
Poor James Buchanan. Yeah. So there had been in Washington a little bit before the inauguration what people were calling the National Hotel Disease, which might have been some form of food poisoning. But there are a lot of really sick people, and I can't believe I'm going to say this on the radio, but there was a lot of diarrhea in Washington.
Oh, my.
And so poor President Buchanan got sick, seemed to get well, and then felt sick again for his inauguration. So he had a doctor standing by just in case things should go badly, I suppose. Not the best way to start your term of office.
Well,
but wasn't the rumor, too, that he was poisoned by arsenic?
Well, yeah, there was a definite rumor about arsenic poisoning, but I think later they discovered that there was an eternal problem in early Washington with sewage. So this is
arsenic sounds so much classier, but we'll move on.
Exactly.
I was trying to get you out of that.
Yeah, well, Ed, we remember that in 2009 there was an issue because Chief Justice John Roberts was swearing in Barack Obama, and he got the words wrong, and he had to go and do it again later on. But in fact, that was not the first time that that has happened. There was Herbert Hoover's 1929 inauguration.
Yeah, and it was kind of more embarrassing because they didn't catch it at the time, but a 13-year-old girl did. Mm. And she was listening on the radio, and she wrote to this is Justice Taft, who, you know, used to be president, and three news networks listen to the footage, and they said, oh, you'd mess it up worse than you thought. So he had to re-administer the oath a few days later because a 13-year-old girl called him on it.
Hmm. What I love about that, though, is that oath-taking moment is such an important moment, right? That's kind of the president moment. And so the fact that you goof up a word or two and then you have to go back and do it again because it messed up the president-making moment.
So many other things changed about all this, but that one moment is really the only thing, I guess, that actually has to happen during that. And so there's a lot of pressure to get that right. But even then, people have wondered, well, do we have to have a Bible? Because most people, you know, have been sworn in a Bible, but several presidents didn't, either because of coincidence or intention. So even the oath is an unstable thing.
Hmm. Well, another thing that is unstable, and it actually is kind of surprising that the inauguration is in January in Washington, D.C., because you never know what the weather's going to be. And you could have tons and tons of people out on the National Mall, and it could be really cold or it could be even hot. This week, it's supposed to be warm and wet. But if you go back to 1873, the second inauguration of Ulysses S. Grant, it was extremely cold.
This is a sad story, so children might want to turn the radio down for a moment because, you know, they were hoping to have a really big inauguration for his second term, Ulysses Grant. His first one, they hadn't had a big enough facility. And so they got a temporary structure, and they outfitted it with all kinds of things except heat and insulation. And so the food and the drinks froze, and unfortunately so did about 100 canaries that had been waiting to add a festive voice to the party.
And actually, 1973 was not a good year for the birds either.
Yeah, there was a little more intentional. They were trying to get rid of the birds, but not kill them, just make them go away with some great stuff called Roost No More, which you get the idea of. And it was supposed to drive the pigeons away, but instead it was supposed to make their feet itchy. I'm not sure how you have pigeons testifying to the itchiness of feet, but they did. But instead, they ate it. And when they did, they died along the route. So you can imagine the sound and feelings of walking along among many dead pigeons. So, yeah, I'm not sure why I'm the sad bird stories, but that gets us the historian's duty.
Okay, well, then let me just bring us back on course here for one second here to Joanne. We're hearing now that President-elect Trump's speech may be about 20 minutes long. As you look back at previous inaugurations, do you see a wide variation in how long the new presidents have spoken for?
Oh, sure. There is a wide variation. At the very beginning, generally speaking, inaugural addresses were short, although John Adams, I believe, had a 700-word sentence in his inaugural address. That's very John Adamsy, you know, sort of, I have things to say and I shall study how to say them best in 700 words. But then you have William Henry Harrison, who gave an enormously long, well over an hour, I think hour and a half address. Yep. Standing outside, no coat on, sort of being, you know, I'm a guy, I'm the president, and I shall stand here and deliver the address.
Well, he was 63 years old. He wanted to show that he was tough and could take it.
Well, we will be watching on Friday, and we'll see how this inauguration stacks up with previous ones. I'm hoping that it is nothing like 1857 and James Buchanan. Ed Ayers and Joanne Freeman, historians and co-hosts of the weekly public radio show and podcast Backstory. Thanks as always.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And we should note on that last point, by the way, that William Henry Harrison died of complications from pneumonia 31 days after his long inaugural address out in the cold.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
Bayer is one of the latest companies promising to create more American jobs. After a meeting with the Trump team, the German chemical company said yesterday it will add several thousand high-tech positions in the U.S. This comes after General Motors promised a $1 billion investment in the U.S., Hyundai promised $3 billion for manufacturing plants here, and Walmart is talking about its plan for 10,000 new jobs this year. So, would these companies have added these jobs without pressure from the president-elect? Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with Bayer, which is also trying to get government approval for its merger with the seedmaker Monsanto. Are these new jobs because of Trump's pressure?
Not all of them, I think it's fair to say. They are white-collar jobs, which is what we are looking for. They're saying they want to add genetic specialists, engineers, data scientists, and that means good-paying jobs. But I think that they certainly plan to keep their headquarters here, and we're probably planning to add these jobs anyway, but sort of trumpeting it at the moment seems like a good idea from a policy perspective. One thing they haven't said, though, is whether there'll be administrative layoffs, so there may not be a net gain here.
It seems like the word trumpeting just took on a whole new meaning there. But what about the other companies we've been talking about, Walmart, Amazon? Were they going to add these jobs anyway?
In a lot of these cases, these companies did have these plans in effect already. Perhaps they sped them up, but Walmart had already announced new store openings. Amazon certainly outlined plans to expand before the election. And I would also say, Jeremy, companies had already been reconsidering the benefits of a stretched out supply chain. You know, quality issues, higher wages in places like China had some companies coming back home anyway. But, and I want to emphasize this, but I think it would be wrong to dismiss Trump's impact altogether. These companies understand the environment has changed. We had the Nissan CEO, Carlos Ghosn, speaking to us in Davos today, and he said the message is clear. We are moving from this free trade world to a new situation that we don't fully understand yet. And he certainly thinks that is going to impact future business decisions. And I think other CEOs might agree with him.
Now, when you look at the overall numbers here, though, and we've been hearing about, it's kind of been trickling out every few days. There's another company that says, we're going to create 10,000 new jobs in the U.S. And Trump comes out and says, great, that's because of me. So the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman wrote that an estimated 75,000 people are laid off or fired on an average day. So when Trump talks about saving a few hundred jobs here or 10,000 jobs here, does it make a difference in the larger economy, or is that just, you know, the normal course of business?
I think what we could say is it's symbolic, perhaps, and that's what Trump's grabbing on. It is on the margin. These job gains that we've been hearing out do not make up for the job losses we've experienced, especially when you look at the really hard-hit manufacturing sector. But I think that there has been, again, a change in sentiment. You know, for a long time now, I think it's fair to say rationalizing costs, which is what companies call job cuts, moving to low labor cost centers in the world was good for business, good for shareholders, period, full stop. Trump's introduced some doubt into that equation now. Can he use a bully pulpit to publicly call out companies? That's only going to work for so long, certainly. But economists that I talked to say if he and Congress can combine that with real tax reform and continue to encourage companies to make investments here in the U.S., that could have a lasting economic impact. So right now, perhaps marginal and symbolic, but it could make a difference if they follow it up with policy.
Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
We're heading down to D.C. later today to broadcast from the NPR studios tomorrow and from the mall for the inauguration Friday. We'll also be covering the parade, joining people from all over the country converging on the Capitol, some to celebrate Friday, some to protest Saturday in the Women's March. Lena Epstein is in the former group. She worked hard to elect Donald Trump as co-chair of the Michigan for Trump campaign and will be there to see him sworn in. She joins us by Skype. So, Lena, how are you feeling about this day approaching?
I couldn't be more excited. It is just a very proud moment for all Americans across all races, demographics, persuasions, economic positions in society. And I couldn't be more excited to have a front row seat and the opportunity to celebrate this tremendously exciting day in our nation's history.
Well, you supported Donald Trump from very early on in the primary and worked for him, as we said, in Michigan. Why? What was it about him over all the other Republican candidates?
I did. I was one of the earliest to publicly declare my support for Donald J. Trump. And a lot of my peers and friends and folks around me thought that I could be potentially risking everything politically to support this man. And I had crystal clear vision as to why he belonged in the president's position. And that is that he was the only person on that stage of fine individuals who was capable of putting deals together to make America the economic stronghold that it once was, to be able to negotiate with other world leaders, China, Russia, to be able to represent America's best interests. He's the only person that will be able to deepen the relationship with Mexico, broaden the relationship with Mexico, make our border safer. And I stuck to my guns the entire time.
Well, but Lena, how are you feeling now that narrative, you know, there's been some chips at it. That, for instance, as a businessman, he actually had many failed businesses that came out during the campaign, that it's not just that he might make a deal with Russia, but there's increasing concern that Russia is using him, that Russia interfered in the election, and that he's become Putin's puppet, as some have said. That, you know, he's now saying, well, Mexico will build the wall and then Mexico will pay us back, which isn't like Mexico building the wall. He obviously won. He is going to be president of the United States, but his approval ratings now have dropped to 40%.
And it's very, very clear that there will always be people that don't want President Trump to be successful. And to them, I say that a successful Trump presidency will lend itself to a successful America. I encourage everybody, naysayers, doubters, people that want to focus entirely on Russia and be skeptical and make connections that are unconfirmed, or those that want to look at a failed business practice, which, by the way, is common practice for most business people to have successes and failures. We're human beings. I would encourage everybody to open up their thoughts, open up their minds to the fact, like you just said, that Donald Trump is going to be our president, and that supporting him, supporting his administration, is only going to make our country stronger.
Yes, there are people saying, once president, you support the president. We're Americans, and we stand together. But I asked you about some of the questions about his capability, not about supporting him because he is president. Did you ever, were there ever seeds of doubt? Or, you know, when the tape surfaced of him speaking in a derogative way about women, was your faith ever shaken?
My faith was never shaken in why I wanted Mr. Trump to be the president of the United States. But I will say that I never once condoned or agreed with those times that he engaged in bad verbal behavior. In fact, even as Michigan co-chair for the campaign, I was extremely verbal in interviews across the state, across the country, and then across the world, that I thought that at times he crossed the line and that was inappropriate. But the cons are far outweighed by the pros. This is a man of conviction. This is a man that will speak the truth. He does want to incite debate, and he does want to bring up the unpopular. I like that. It's something that I believe that America needs.
But, and I know you're heading for this, you know, huge day for you, the inauguration day. But this is an unusual election, an unusual inauguration. You have dozens of lawmakers who aren't attending. You have the Trump campaign having a difficulty getting people to perform, people dropping out, Jennifer Holliday, the Bruce Springsteen cover band dropping out. Is that raining on your parade a little bit?
It weighs on my internal parade, for sure. And that's because I see us as such a country disunited. And that really brings me a lot of hurt and a lot of pain and a lot of concern for our future. I think that now more than ever is a time when our nation needs to unite. And I don't mean that to be rhetorical or in words only. We need to take whatever actions are necessary from within the Trump camp, from within the protesters' camp, from within every camp in between. We need to be seeking conversations, seeking ways to come together. I am extraordinarily concerned with everything that you just said. Every question that you've asked me, I agree with. You're raising the right questions. You're asking the right questions. We are so disunified. And will the President Trump have what it takes to bring the country together? I believe that it's possible.
Well, meanwhile, here you have ahead of you the inauguration ceremony, the parade, balls. You're going to one of the two balls that President Trump will attend. What are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to giving him a hug. I'm looking forward to thanking my president for being brave and persevering through a very, very difficult and ugly election cycle. I'm really looking forward to celebrating this day with my husband. I'm a newlywed. And that'll be such a beautiful day for us to share together in our nation's capital. And I'm also looking forward to celebrating with peers, folks that I work with on the campaign trail from around the country. I'm looking forward to having my 2 feet on our nation's capital the moment that he's sworn in.
That's Lena Epstein. She was co-chair of the Trump for Michigan campaign, and she is looking forward to enjoying the inauguration. Lena, thank you.
Robin, thank you so much. It's really been an honor and a pleasure.
Well, let's go to the city of Portland, Oregon now, which is taking heat for not doing enough to respond to a cold snap and a series of snow and ice storms over the past 3 weeks or so. Amelia Templeton is a reporter for Here Now contributor, Oregon Public Broadcasting. She's in Portland. And Amelia, wow, I mean, some schools closed for days. How bad has it been?
Well, you know, we had just yesterday a major interstate highway shut down for a while. We have parents going pretty nuts because their kids have been cooped up for, you know, 5 or 6 days in a row. It's been bad. Many of the streets have been clear. Many other streets have been totally impassable. On my block, a snowplow never arrived during the entirety of the storm.
Well, that's because we understand that Portland doesn't do some residential streets. Look, Portland's new mayor, Ted Wheeler, has only been in office since the new year. So welcome to Portland, Mr. Wheeler. But he held a press conference yesterday saying he was deeply humbled, apologized for his city's response. Let's listen.
We've experienced too many street closures. Schools have been closed day after day after day. Businesses have lost out on economic opportunity. And most importantly of all, people have died on our streets. And as I said earlier, that is an unacceptable outcome.
And Amelia, it's also so sad. These are homeless people?
Yes. 4 homeless people that we know of have died of hypothermia since the year began. Mm. 2 of those people were severely mentally ill, and it appears that they were sort of afraid of other people. Mm-hmm. One was a 29-year-old man who was found in the woods by the side of a road. Another was a 52-year-old woman who'd been recently evicted and whose family had been trying to sort of find her and take care of her, but they didn't know where she was. And she died of exposure in a parking garage. Mm-hmm. And then 2 additional men died, one on the street and another at a hospital after he was found hypothermic at a bus stop.
Well, then we also understand a baby was found. The medical people ruled the child had been stillborn with a homeless mom at a Portland bus stop. This is, still under investigation, but just terrible. Look, are there calls there to change? Portland only has 55 snowplows. They use a liquid de-icer instead of salt because of concerns about salt getting into the groundwater. Are people saying we have to amp it up a bit?
Yeah, I think the public is extremely frustrated with the city's response to the storm. You mentioned salt. You know, we have environmental concerns here. We have salmon that migrate through the city, and so we've been reluctant to use salt in the past. But yeah. Our transportation commissioner has said he wants to revisit both the decision to not salt the streets and also whether in the future we need to really plow residential areas as well as the main thoroughfares.
Maybe buy some more snow plows. But we feel for you. Amelia Templeton of Oregon Public Broadcasting, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
More than 1 million undergraduate and graduate students from overseas come to study in the U.S. every year with visas in hand. Graduate students in particular are big business for colleges. But as Jill Kaufman of New England Public Radio reports, President-elect Trump's many anti-immigration stances have brought some uncertainty.
Young men and women from China, India, Saudi Arabia, and Korea make up the largest number of international students coming to the U.S. Their top areas of study, science and technology research, engineering and math, known collectively as the STEM fields.
Ultimately, anyone gets into STEM because they believe, or at least they hope, that they want to change the world.
22-year-old Archit Rastogi is doing his PhD in molecular and cellular biology at UMass Amherst, the University of Massachusetts.
At the moment, I'm working on studying how fetal exposure to certain environmental toxins can lead to diseases later in life.
He is here on an F1 visa, and he's part of a growing trend. A 2014 National Science Foundation report found the number of international students earning degrees in STEM fields rose by 35%. The number of U.S. citizens, on the other hand, fell 5%. That's one reason international students are in demand at big research schools like UMass, UCLA, and Purdue University. Another reason, money. Their tuition is sometimes higher and often paid in full. And the STEM knowledge they bring allows schools to apply for millions in research grants, which they need to keep running.
You know, there's a set amount of money, like if it's a $1 million grant, so UMass will get $420,000 on that $1 million grant.
And schools are doing a lot of recruiting.
Going to college and studying in the United States has been a dream come true for us.
As current F status international students studying here in the United States, we know firsthand all the great things an American education can provide, not only for us.
The Department of Commerce estimates in 2015, international students contributed more than $30.5 billion to the U.S. economy. But if you listen to the incoming president,
I want the next generation of production and innovation to happen right here on our great homeland, America.
And among Trump's initial actions,
on immigration, I will direct the Department of Labor to investigate all abuses of visa programs that undercut the American worker.
Right after the election, university administrators like Ken Reed, who runs the International Student Program at UMass Amherst, began hearing from prospective students overseas and those on campus.
I think something that none of us have completely comprehended yet is how this is going to impact international admissions.
Sitting in his office, Reed points to a document written 2 years ago by U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions. It's called the Immigration Handbook for the New Republican Majority.
So I made these for you. This is for you, just in case it's helpful for you.
Sessions is Trump's nominee for Attorney General and chair of the Senate Subcommittee on Immigration and the National Interest.
He has some very specific things that really have potential impact on international students. What's called OPT, or Optional Practical Training, which is a work authorization that international students get after they complete studies.
The OPT is really important, Reed says. It allows postdoctoral students, for instance, to get work visas known as H-1Bs. And that is what usually allows their research to get out of academia and into the marketplace. But those work visas are what Sessions has a problem with. In that memo from January 2015, Sessions cited a study that showed foreign students take jobs away from Americans, and he said the shortage of qualified Americans with degrees in the STEM fields is a false claim. Other data disputes that. No matter what happens, Reed predicts Trump's statements about immigration reform and building a wall have already scared off some foreign students.
You know, we're at an all-time high for international enrollment in the United States. And statistically right now, to see the impact next year, it should be pretty noticeable.
Jobs are one thing, threats to national security another. Before he was elected, Trump's original plan to ban all Muslims from entering the U.S. morphed into, quote, extreme vetting of Muslims from certain areas of the world. Alan Goodman says international students are among the most vetted visitors to the United States, Muslim or otherwise. Goodman directs the International Institute of Education, which conducts annual surveys of foreign students.
After 9/11, the U.S. instituted the requirement that there be personal interviews for every visa seeker and holder. We have the staff today. We have the procedures. And the international students coming here remain the most closely credentialed of any group of persons entering the United States.
Over the past few weeks, many schools in the U.S. sent out a round of acceptance letters, and in a matter of weeks, prospective students will start responding yes or no. Grad student Archit Rastogi says he knows a lot of people who are at the very end of their PhDs.
And they're really close to doing all these great, amazing, crucial things, but they're very worried because they have to reapply for their visa, and by the time they reapply for the visa, the administration will have changed.
Rastogi says he came to the U.S. to do research in state-of-the-art labs that don't yet exist in India. He's got about 4 years left and eventually plans to return home. He's lucky, he says. His visa doesn't run out until 2021. For Here and Now, I'm Jill Kaufman.
And Jill's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.